Norton, president of Livestock Publications Council, and this is our first ever vision and industry celebration. We are glad that you are a part of it, and we're especially appreciative of our panel and moderator for their role in it. Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated radio show AgriTalk, is going to be our moderator for this event, and I'm going to let him introduce our three panelists as we proceed. Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for being here. Certainly it's an important topic, but it's not a new topic. Those of us have been around a decade or two, to put it nicely, or three, Cliff, as old as you are. But, you know, you go back far enough. I can remember in the early days, remember when animal rights groups were doing some things, and the big question among producers, do we say anything? Do we respond and give them more attention, or do we just kind of ignore them and hope they go away? Obviously, they didn't go away. The topic didn't go away. The subject didn't go away. It's grown now. It's a more important issue. And even though those of us here maybe could be accused of talking to the choir here or preaching to the choir, talking to ourselves, there are so many levels and layers to this that it's important that we do talk among ourselves, get a better understanding of the issues that we're dealing with, because I think many in agriculture have found themselves kind of, what do we do? How do we handle this? How do we respond? How do we get our message out? And there are a lot of different angles to this from a marketing standpoint, the social aspect of it. How do we relate to customers and consumers that don't understand what we do? We've all kind of struggled with how best to get our message out. So we're going to come at this issue, the animal welfare issue, the critical issue that we're dealing with today, because we know how our industry has been labeled at times, how it's been defined at times, and we know oftentimes that's misleading and inaccurate, but it's a perception that some consumers have in their minds that we are having to deal with and trying to get this dealt with on a, hopefully, a factual standpoint and then give consumers good information for them to make educated decisions. So we're going to come at it from a lot of different aspects here, from an economic standpoint. We have also from Iowa State University, Dr. Hans Kutsia is going to be with us and talk about some of the issues that he is looking at. But I want to start from the producer standpoint, a rancher, a wife, and a mom. So Debbie Lyons Blythe touches a lot of the areas that we are dealing with from the production side and the consumer side. So, Debbie, I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm going to let them tell you as much about themselves as they want to and then get some overall thoughts from each one of them. Then we're going to open it up for questions. So, Debbie, we'll start with you.
Well, I don't want to take a whole lot of the time that could be actually used for our discussion or our questions, but just to tell you a little bit about the introduction that he had, the reason that I go ahead and identify myself as a rancher, a wife, and a mom is because I'm also very, very active in social media and trying to connect with consumers. So I am the cattle rancher in our family, and my husband is a banker. And so I am the person that's there every single day. We have five kids, and they've all been very, very active on the farm with us, taking care of the cattle. But I'm also a blogger. And the way to connect with bloggers and with other people that are reading blogs is to be one of them. So if I tell them I'm a mom, that makes a whole lot more sense to them if I say I'm a cattle rancher. So some of you may not think that's a very impressive thing on a resume, but frankly, it's very important to me. Anybody who's a mom or a dad feels that way too. So just a tiny little bit about our cattle ranch. We live south of White City, which is a tiny little town. And if you're not on the way to White City, you've not been there. So there's no reason to go through there if you're not on your way there. It has population about 400, and it's south of Manhattan. I grew up in Manhattan, Kansas, and I'd never heard of White City until I met this guy. So we're big K-State fans. We've got an Angus cattle ranch. We sell registered bulls and commercial females for a heifer production program and really enjoy doing that. And we are looking for ways to pass on to the next generation. Of my five kids, it sounds like four of them are interested in coming home to the ranch. Now, we can go on in another whole conversation about how we're going to make that happen to have four of them come home. That's going to take an awful lot of coordination, but that's not a discussion today. Today, the most important thing to me is that we still have a beef industry and that we still have the ability to ranch and take care of ourselves and take care of cattle the way that we want to and the way that we've done it for many years. So that involves not only connecting with consumers, but also connecting with legislators. because they're consumers too, but they're making big decisions for us. So I spend an awful lot of my time trying to make those connections and discuss with people, and I tweet from the tractor pretty frequently. Taking pictures of myself today with cows in the background, take a selfie. It's called a felfie, a farmer selfie. So anyway, so I can speak to the consumer perspective. I took my coveralls off just to come here at noon. I had to get on the road and get cleaned up before I could make it up here. So I am boots on the ground, and I'm very comfortable discussing that with people. So I'm able to take those kind of questions, and I'm really excited. I hope I can say something smart. These fellows, I'm really looking forward to hearing what they have to say.
All right, Debbie, thank you. Also with us is Dr. Hans Kutsia. He's professor of veterinary clinical pharmacology at Iowa State University. Hans, if you'd come with us, please. We won't talk K-State, Iowa State here, right?
We almost beat them.
We're not going to win that.
So I'm Hans Kutsia, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today and the invitation. This is a unique opportunity for us to talk about some of the things we do at Iowa State. And my background is I grew up on a dairy farm in South Africa. We milked 800 cows, and we also registered Hereford cattle. So with that background, I went to veterinary school in South Africa, trained for 6 years, and then moved to the UK and worked in Ireland in practice for a few years before coming to Iowa State and doing my PhD. I was then on faculty at Kansas State for 5 years, so I do have a little purple in me, just a little tad, before going back to Iowa State, where I run a research program that's focused primarily on how we measure and assess pain in cattle and pigs. So our research has been well supported by the USDA NIFA program and by the National Pork Board. And we really have two goals with our research program. The one is to try to identify effective, cost-effective pain management strategies for use in cattle and pigs. And the second goal is to try to demonstrate that there's some kind of production upside to managing pain. Because I find whenever we talk with producers, the question inevitably comes, how do we pay for this? Because we generally figure out the consumer's not going to pay for it. So we have to try to demonstrate that there's some kind of benefit to that. In addition to that, in my spare time, I serve as chair-elect of the AVMA Animal Welfare Committee, and I'm also boarded in animal welfare through the AVMA, and I'm also boarded in clinical pharmacology. So my work dovetails very closely with animal welfare-type issues. It's something that keeps us very busy. And so I'm fortunate to be able to bring both the producer and kind of scientist perspective to this conversation. But primarily on this panel, I'd be happy to address kind of scientific type questions. What are some of the challenges in terms of assessing pain, managing pain, and then also broader issues about, you know, what consumers think of this whole issue of pain management and pain assessment and why we need to focus on it. So those are primarily the things that I'd be happy to discuss, and along with any other issues that might come up. So, again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and look forward to visiting with you.
All right. And, again, how quickly information gets out. I felt my phone buzzing here and saw Chuck with his phone in his hand, so I knew the agri-blogger was at it. So the word's getting out already here. All right. And, Our third panelist is Steve Meyer, president of Paragon Economics. Of course, many of you know him as a consultant to the National Pork Board and National Pork Producers Council. Steve.
Thanks, Mike. Good afternoon, everyone. I can't speak for Hans, but you'll have no problem sounding smart relative to me. it is good to be with you. Many of you I know from previous encounters, and glad to be here to talk about the economic aspects of animal welfare and animal rights. It's been a situation fraught with peril for U.S. livestock producers as we've tried to address these kind of topics. Obviously, in meeting the demands of those groups who are pushing this agenda, there are cost issues that will eventually impact supply. One of the things that we've been afraid of all along is that there are huge demand issues involved in these kind of topics. I'm here to tell you that so far the data says that that's not been a factor. Now, unlike Hans, we economists are not blessed with the ability to have control groups. We have to observe what happens in the economy and try to make sense of that People don't like being put in test tubes as the control group over here. And so one of the things we'll never know is what would have happened had we not had all of this animal rights and animal welfare activity over the last 10 years. It's in the market. But I can tell you that at least relative to the other forces on meat demand, it's been insignificant so far. And we can talk about specifics on that because meat demand has been on a roll the last couple of years that we haven't seen in many years. And even at the time that all this is going on, and so one of the conclusions I've come to is that, you know, for instance, in the pork industry, when one of these videos comes out, everyone in the pork industry gets their hair on fire and very concerned about it, and all of the activist groups get their hair on fire and they're concerned about it. And it looks to me like all the consumers yawn. It doesn't look like there's really anything there, and it goes back to a contention I've had for some time that, you know, and a question is this really a consumer issue? And I think the activist groups have tried to make it a consumer issue. I would say that the evidence that's out there so far says they haven't really succeeded very well in that, so we'll see what happens in the future. That doesn't mean you can dismiss it. It doesn't mean that you need to look elsewhere, but I think it is a fact that we've seen very strong meat demand in the last couple of years especially, and there are factors out there that are much more important than this on the demand side so far. Again, we need to be vigilant, but that's kind of my observation. I've been working in the pork industry for many, many years, first as a staff economist at MPPC and the Pork Board for about 10 years, and then for the last 12 years as a consultant, still working with them. Have degrees at Iowa State and Oklahoma State, and neither one of those football teams are very good this year. So I've been around the business quite a while, and be glad to try to address any questions you have on the economics of this situation. Mike?
I'll start off with the first question, then we'll open it up to folks here in attendance. Let's follow up on the video. In fact, Hans and I were talking about this. I think we agreed, too, that the wow factor seems to be off of that now because so many of them have come out. But we know that it is a concern to some, and it does – what we have seen is that push from those groups trying to put pressure on a McDonald's or whoever it may be to then put pressure on producers to change production practices. Steve, can you give us your thoughts on is that pressure lessening or are we going to see more of that and what's the impact for producers dealing with that kind of pressure?
Well, I think the track record of announcements by food service companies, by retailers or something, it says that the pressure is not as severe as it was. I mean, there was a time that it seemed like every day there was a new one coming out saying, oh, you know, and responding to these videos. That slowed, and one of the reasons, though, is they ran out of companies to make announcements, okay? I mean, there aren't very many left. Most of them have. But I think the reality of the situation is coming to bear on the ones that made these announcements, and the reality is that there's not very much product out there, not nearly enough product to satisfy all their demands for these kind of products. And so they're coming to the brutal conclusion that they may have to pay more for them. That's an economic principle that seemed to have been lost on them when they were making the announcements, but it certainly, I think it is coming home to roost to a great degree on these. So, I think things are better. The other reason's better is I think producers are doing a better job of, A, making sure there aren't as many videos being done by doing a better job on the farm. And there have been groups that have been successful in countering some of these things. There's been a lot more transparency by the industry. And so, you know, if you don't have something to hide, then people aren't quite as interested in this. There have been a lot of moves by the producer groups that have, I think, been quite positive in this regard. And so, but it's all going to come down to supply and demand at some point. And when people are demanding something that's going to cost more to produce, then it will eventually cost more to buy because if you can't produce it, you're not going to, and the supply will tighten up and those prices will rise. And so, in the end, consumers pay all costs. So if somebody in between consumers and producers impose some cost, the consumer is going to get to pay it. And they'll realize that at some point. I think they already have. And that's one of the reasons I think we're getting a little less traction on these than we did at one time.
And Hans, I know talking with you, you pointed to that fact too. Are consumers willing to pay more to have radical changes in production practices?
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges that we face, is that consumers intrinsically, if you ask a consumer, do you think animals should be cared for better, their response is going to be yes. You know, that it's just the way the questions are phrased. But if you ask them in the context of, are you prepared to spend $1.50 per pound more on raising this pork because it's free range and we can't keep as many of them, that's going to be the question that's really going to be telling. I think one of the challenges we also have as an industry is deciding which of the issues we can defend and which ones we can't. Because frankly, there are some issues that we will struggle to defend to consumers, one of them being castration dehorning without analgesia. You know, most people, if you talk to folks about pain relief, they assume that when they take their dog to be spayed and neutered, he comes home with a bottle of pain pills and you give him for the next 5 days. But we don't do that in ag. And so that's one of the questions that often gets asked about the practices that we perform, is that there's issues about things we can defend and things we can't defend. And it's interesting the effect that this has had. I'm sure some of you are aware, in January of this year, Tyson sent out a letter to all their pork producers. And in that letter, they made a statement that they wanted all pigs to be castrated with analgesia. We don't have a single drug approved in the United States for pain relief. But Tyson, one of our biggest packers, is saying they want all piglets castrated with pain relief. So it's a real challenge for the industry, is how do you address that? Because you can't legally use anything unless you fall on MDUCA, which is a very complex piece of legislation, or else you have to find something that's approved in order to address this demand from one of the biggest purchasers of the product. And that's one of the challenges we have, is how do we balance these demands of the industry, some of which are reasonable and some of which are not.
Debbie, as a producer, how do you feel when these videos come out?
Oh, gosh, those videos are hideous. They're awful, and they upset every good producer that's out there. And, you know, the thing that I always like to say to my social media audience that I'm talking to when one of those videos comes out is I will find those people and hunt them down, too. I feel just as bad when I see a cow mistreated as they do. They may think, they turn their head, they can't look at it, I can't either. I can't see any of those. And so if I ever see anybody mistreating an animal, I feel the exact same way. I appreciate what you say about the pain relief that we don't have available right now, and that's a big concern to me as a producer as well. That's being asked for us to do, and as a producer, I agree. I don't want to see my animals in pain. We work very hard, as you well know, to identify those animals that are in pain because they don't eat as well. They don't gain as well. They'll go hide in a corner of the pen and lay down. Well, they're not eating, they're not gaining, they're not being productive at that time. So I lose those days that they're not actually feeling very well. So I work very hard to make sure that I'm trained well. You have to keep in mind that an animal, if they're not comfortable with me, will hide their pain too. And so I have to be very well known to those animals so that they will not feel that I'm a fear, you know, a reason to be afraid and to hide that pain. So, you know, it's the weakest survive, or weakest don't survive, the strongest survive. That's exactly what they do, is they hide their pain, they hide their weakness. So we have to work really hard to identify that and be good at that, and I'm not sure everybody really is worried about that at this point. But I do think people care. If you're raising cows, you like cows. And so you don't want to see them hurting. That's what matters to me.
All right, questions? That's a question, and direct it to one of the panelists. Yeah, Greg?
I'm going to have to defer to somebody else on the millennials, and I don't know if anybody up here can answer that question.
Sure.
Can you? Okay.
I'll let you answer that.
And you want to follow up then, or you want to go ahead and start with something?
Yeah, I would say my comments are based on just market-wide demand figures. I mean, if we look at the combination of per capita consumption or per capita availability over the last 2 or 3 years and prices paid, demand for beef and pork is at the highest level since 2004, for sure, and possibly since the early 1990s, okay? There's been a dramatic shift in taste and preferences in the last 2 or 3 years. One of them, a part of that is an interest in dietary protein, a lot more interested in that, a lot more concern about it, and also the whole situation with saturated fat. And I noticed on your silent auction you have a couple of copies of the Big Fat Surprise and the article that was in Time magazine this summer and others that says, you know, we got it wrong about this back in the 70s. So I'm looking, you know, industry-wide, market-wide, just you know, large indicators. I'm not looking at any one target group, and I'd have to defer to someone else to talk about that.
You'll wait and see what I say. Yeah, see if I say anything smart. Yeah, whatever. So I'm raising 5 millennials. All of my kids are in that. My kids are from 23 to 19. And so they are connected. They have got their cell phone. They have got the internet. It's all at their fingertips. And my son just got one of those phones that you talk to and it answers you back. Okay, Google, now do this. And it does. And hey, okay, Google, now where is this? How is this done? How is this raised? And they're asking their phones these questions and they're popping up with answers. So I think that this is a perfect opportunity. I use that as a wonderful jumping off point to connect with the millennials, because I think that if we flood the internet with good information, my goal is always that if my website be the first one or my blog be the first one that pops up when somebody asks, how are cattle raised? That's what I hope. That's my goal. That doesn't happen very often, I would imagine, and it's got to be pretty targeted to catch up with my blog. But my thought is to, as far as the millennials, if they have maybe seen my blog once, maybe they're not a regular reader, and I don't even know if the millennials are regular readers of a certain blog or a certain magazine. They're just getting all this information online. They're asking questions, and whichever website answers that question is the one that they're listening to and paying attention to at the time. I have another follow-up to that one, but let me just say, I think we've got to be able to reach those people one issue at a time. So if they see a video that comes up and they say, maybe mistreating dairy animals, they say, hey, wait a minute. I read a blog by this gal one time that said that, boy, they love cows too. So that doesn't really ring true with me. I'm going to dig a little deeper. We've got to teach them to dig a little deeper. I think they want to know, but they don't necessarily know what are the good sources. And my example for that is my son was writing a term paper his senior year in high school. And some of you may have heard this. I already see a couple of grins. Some of you may have already heard my story. And it was a huge major term paper that he had to do a lot of research in a bibliography. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is my thing, because I'm actually an ag communications graduate. So I was really psyched that I was going to help him with all of his sources and his bibliography. Interestingly enough, he didn't have to have one book cited for his research. They could all be websites. I said, I'm okay with that, but they have to be reputable websites. And they have to be things that you can follow up on and have statistics or reports or research, not just any old website, Dr. Oz. I mean, you know, whatever. Wikipedia for one, too. That's, you know, written by us. So I think it's really important that we teach the millennials how they need to research.
Now with the higher institutions rebuttal here to the condemnation of our educational system. Go right ahead.
Okay.
I will not dispute that Wikipedia turns up a lot in term papers, and it's very much one of the primary sources that gets cited. And being around college kids every day, we have some kind of insights into some of their thinking. We've sort of had some discussions with them about some of the welfare work that we do. We very often have folks involved in our research that have not come from farms. But it seems to me that there's a lot more desire within this group to try to connect with where the food comes from, and that we've seen where these farmers markets have sprung up in every little town, and even, you know, on these tight college budgets with the soaring tuition that we hear about, most of our students still shop at a farmers market or eat at Chipotle, which is kind of high dollar for the regular, you know, student. When I was a student, we didn't used to eat out near as much as our current students do. But they have a lot of interest in finding out where the food comes from. They like to connect. This whole local food thing seems to be quite prevalent within that population. And so I think we could do a pretty nice job very often by just giving them that connection that they're looking for. And I think folks like the Peterson Brothers have done a really nice job with that. They found out what these kids like to listen to music-wise, and now they're offering tours of their farm. And so having that connection, providing this group of the population the opportunity to connect with where the food comes from, I think gets past a lot of the challenges of, you know, this misinformation of trying to find the pieces that you alluded to, and having to do the research in addition to that is also just providing them with that opportunity to say, this is where your food comes from, and lo and behold, it's not a terrible place.
Chuck?
Yeah, I do have a question, but I did Google how are cattle raised.
I didn't come up, did I?
Not number one. First one is cows raised for meat from the Food Empowerment Project. Then we've got California Cattlemen, ExploreBeef.org, something called PETA. And then the sixth one is how to raise cattle in 10 steps with pictures.
You don't want to look at all the websites he goes to, by the way.
So a question I've got is, I'm not sure exactly how to frame this succinctly, but when we have organizations, there's quite a few that are investing really millions of dollars in trying to affect consumer opinion about where their food comes from. I'd say in a positive way from the farmer's point of view. Kind of thing. While we're doing that, economics show we're selling a lot of beef for a pretty high price. I'll tell you what, I looked at some steaks the other day at Walmart. I was like, holy, you know what? I can't believe how much these things are. I mean, is it possible that we tend to see the social media element of it because it's so visible to us who are involved and think everybody, when I kind of wonder if the percentage of the market out there that's going to buy the customers, what percentage really are these wackos, you know? And are we kind of overreacting?
In other words, are we paranoid, right?
Yeah, and are we overreacting?
Are we? What do you think?
Well, that was my point when I said every time one of these things come out, it looks like the producers and the activists get all up in arms, and the data says that the rest of the population doesn't pay any attention. Okay, I mean, if they do, it hasn't affected their behavior negatively and what they're willing to pay for these products the last couple of years. Okay, so I would say that, again, across the marketplace, not just for individual groups, the evidence is that they haven't had much of an impact. Now, there is a possibility that things would have even been better had we not had these things to deal with. But to be very honest, I, as an economist who's watched this business for 25 years, I can't imagine how that could be, okay? Because it's been an awfully good run on the demand side from every way that we can figure that. And it happened at a time when the income levels were not up. I mean, the economy hadn't grown robustly. Disposable income hadn't grown much, and yet people are willing to do this. So I think the evidence, as I see it as an economist, is that what you've said is accurate. And that doesn't mean that those individual groups can't cause you a lot of trouble, because at some point they've got the ear of some legislators probably that can impose rules on
Let me ask that
the market doesn't do.
Yeah, from another perspective, I think we accept there's going to be plenty of meat eaters as long as we have meat. But what if these groups are able to get things passed that make it hard to raise the meat, the animals, and then eventually you dry up the product, if you lose the product, then – doesn't matter if they want to eat it or not, that's not there. Is that
the concern? They'll do it at a price, Mike. I mean, that price is probably going to go up. And so, you know, the point that I made back when we were raising the cost of grain dramatically with government policies was that, you know, you're probably not going to put meat high enough that it's going to impact what we eat at the Meijer household. But I know a lot of people that it would. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not an issue for most people in this room. It's an issue for a lot of people that aren't in this room that don't have the means to have a decent piece of meat at a meal when these prices get this high, and that's the ones that are going to suffer from this. it's interesting, too, that in many cases these are very elitist groups that are fighting this, and you know, they don't sit on the other side of that table.
I think that my sense is that up until now, retailers have chosen not to make animal welfare a point of product differentiation. I think if that changes, I think it might change a lot of consumer views of things, because if suddenly McDonald's decides they're going to label everything welfare friendly, folks are going to ask, what does that mean? And the consequence of that is then an examination of production practices that may be sort of higher profile than what it has been now. So I think part of this is also going to be driven by retail groups in terms of how these things are marketed and how this develops moving forward. And I think it's exactly what's been said. It's the risk of the extreme becoming normal, and all you need to do is put this on a ballot and phrase it like, do you want animals to be kept in better conditions? Everyone's going to vote yes for that. So most folks aren't going to think about it to the extent of what does this actually mean on a practical level in terms of increase of expenditure on food. They're going to look at it superficially in terms of how is this marketed. And the ballot initiatives in California are a great example of that. It doesn't matter how good your commercials are. If your commercials are, do you want animals to be raised better, folks are going to vote for that. And that's the challenge, is keeping that extreme from becoming normal. And I think that you pointed that out. I think it's one of those things that we are going to have to deal with in terms of balancing the discussion so that that extreme doesn't become normal.
And you guys have all said all the smart things. So the only thing that I think that to add to that would be possibly that I believe that the leaders of the animal rights and don't really have animal welfare at their core purpose. They are after money. They've got the people that really love animals then working for them. But the people that are really focused on fighting us are not the people that really love animals.
I think one of the things that sort of I point to when you look at animal welfare, too, is kind of the organic versus conventional discussion, because I think that that's kind of an interesting sort of precursor of what might happen is if we had a welfare-friendly versus non-welfare-friendly raised discussion with retailers. And one of the main concerns I've had about organic is, apart from the absence of scientific data that it's generally better for you, is that it's really cast the spotlight on antimicrobial use. And so the consequence has been is folks are now looking at how antibiotics are used in production agriculture far more closely, because a lot of that spotlight was put on that topic because the organic folks went out and said, we don't use antibiotics. So it's the same kind of discussion could happen with animal welfare, where scientifically there's no difference in terms of whether that food's healthier for you or not, but it's used as that point of product differentiation that then causes specific aspects within production agriculture to be highlighted, and those are the challenges that are far more difficult for us to manage.
Perfect.
Question, Pam?
What's the statistics on how many consumers want that organic or natural or no animal or antibiotic-free? What's the percentage of the market?
I'm not familiar with that.
I'm not familiar with that either.
I would say it's not a significant percentage, but it's the effect of those people wanting that product and their reasons for doing so that is the risk for the conventional raised. So even if it's a very small proportion, the fact that it exists and that gets advertised to exist is the antimicrobial discussion, is that because we have organic, even though a very small proportion of us might choose to purchase organic, the fact that organic exists and its product differentiation is I don't use an antibiotic means that folks are now looking at conventional and saying, why do these guys use this amount of antibiotic and what's the risks for me? And so even though it's small, its impacts can be pretty significant.
And even though it's small, is it going up, do you think?
I wouldn't say it's going up. I think people just can't afford it. It's probably leveled out. But again, it's. I think the train has left the station proverbially on that discussion, because antibiotics, there's legislation out there that's terrifying in terms of what it's going to do for our ability to use antibiotics, and it's a whole separate discussion. But the same kind of thing could happen with welfare, I think, if that becomes a point of product differentiation.
Hans, I've contended for some time that perhaps we need to be a little more aggressive on this and point out that antibiotics are a pro-animal welfare situation. Animals are better off because of antibiotics. I was shocked at a news story a few years ago about an organic hog farmer in Iowa, And the Des Moines Register reporter asked him, he said, well, what about a pig gets sick? And the guy said, well, we just hope they get better. And I thought, now that's a great animal welfare point. I mean, if they care for them so much that they just hope they get better. I thought the guy should have all of his animals taken away from him the next day. I mean, you know, if you can't care more than that. So this is, I know there are downsides to that argument. I understand. But, you know, one of the reasons we use the things is it's better for the animals.
And I agree. But we also have to remember that people are really concerned about what's better for them. They say they're interested in what's better for the animals, but they really want to know what's better for them. But I do think that one of the things that's come out of that discussion that I wasn't necessarily so willing to listen to, but now I've kind of tried to open my mind a little bit more, is the discussion about probiotics and that kind of thing for animals. I at first thought that was a lot of hooey natural medicine type of a thing, but you know, the discussion about it, as a person that raises ruminants, I know that rumen health is really, really important for my cattle. And so that the more I thought about it, the more sense that made. And so actually my vet came out, I had him come out to treat a couple of calves that were chronic bloaters, and he gave them probiotics, and guess what? They've not bloated again. So I don't know. I just think that that's opened up some other opportunities for us to look at some other ways to treat animals. And maybe that an antibiotic might be the second choice in some cases. Of course, bloat, I'm not using an antibiotic for that. But, you know, I think that we work really hard. We really care about our animals and how they look and how healthy they are. And I think that's really important. But in my sense, when I was hearing that about the probiotics, I was really closed-minded. And so I now listen to consumers, and that may be an important discussion to have, and tell them that we're looking. I'm willing. I also feel like there's a time and a place for an antibiotic.
Maybe we could work with the dairy industry and get a cattle yogurt product to take care of.
There you go. Feed to my cows.
There we
yeah.
go. All right. Yes.
So there's a couple of challenges here. I think the pharmaceutical industry has looked at this and said, where's the market? And so that's been one of the holdups. The other issue has been FDA. FDA has a guidance document called Guidance 123, and that particular document has a statement in it that in order for a drug to be approved for pain relief, the basis of the approval has to involve the use of validated methods of pain assessment. And I really appreciated your comments earlier about how difficult it is in a stoic species like cattle to find a validated method of pain assessment. We've spent 7 years studying this, and I still think we haven't found one that's 100% validated. So that's one of the issues, and I think FDA has demonstrated a willingness now to talk and have that conversation. But drug companies are looking at this as can be expected in a free market capitalist economy. What's in it for me? It's a chicken and the egg type situation, because if there was a drug approved tomorrow for pain relief, the retailers might say, well, you're obligated to use it, and so that'll boost the market for the drug company. But the drug companies aren't wanting to take that risk. And so we've got this weird situation that exists where companies are not wanting to pursue analgesic drug approvals because they don't know what the market looks like, but the market's saying we can't use any analgesic drugs because nothing's approved. And so under veterinary supervision, producers can use drugs in an extra label manner. And one of the drugs we've studied is a compound called meloxicam. And we found that there's some really interesting benefits when you use meloxicam. You see less respiratory disease in high-stress cattle after castration. You see improved weight gain performance. And frankly, when you talk to producers who use it, a lot of them just say, heck, those cows don't look as bad the day after we castrate them. And that's oftentimes the biggest incentive for using a compound, is because folks love their cattle. And they don't want them to look bad, and they know they look bad the day after you castrate them. And when you give them pain relief, they look better. And so it costs next to nothing to use meloxicam, but it has to be used under veterinary supervision. There's a whole bunch of regulations involved. The challenge is, if a drug company gets a meloxicam approval tomorrow, the price is going to go up, and then are we going to be able to convince producers to use it? And so that's the challenge here, is finding that balance between cost of the drug approval versus the market, versus what will eventually be required from producers in order to provide pain relief. And that's an economics question as much as anything else.
Can I comment?
There is some interesting work that's been done off-patent meloxicam, but from the point of view of using it in cattle, livestock producers can use it, but the veterinary supervision part is the challenge. Yeah. So that's the part where you can use human generic meloxicam tablets, but it has to be done under the authorization of a veterinarian, and that's where it gets challenging.
The reason I ask is you get the veterinary, you get some kind of approval for it. If it's off-patent, there'll be plenty of people make it. Okay, so you know the price may go up for a while, but you know we're all there are a lot of capitalists out there, so they'll get right with that. I think you know we're going to look for other products to do some of these things. I mean, do you have a product that you can use for castration that doesn't involve surgery? Yes, it's available right now. It's on the market. Uses an immune response to basically stop the testicle growth and create barrows out of boars. So, you know, there's going to be more looking at those kind of products. Now, you know, are those consumer accepted as well? That's still been a question. You've got to change if you have animals that are going through packing plants that still have testicles. That changes the whole, some of the slaughter processes and what you have to do there. And so, you know, it's a system approach, and one of the things, one of the problems here is the same point with the pain medication. There's an economies of size and economies of scale and a critical mass issue here. You don't want to do it until you've got enough of it, and getting from here to having enough of it is not easy to do. So we have systems in place that have to be changed, and the only way to do that is that there has to be enough value at the end of that process to get it done, and no one can be, you know, guaranteed of that. When is the value look large enough that someone will take the risk? That's the question.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I think one of the biggest questions we get from the medical community, and we interact with MDs quite frequently, is this whole issue of overuse of antibiotics. Because, again, I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, and the station that's right by the Capitol, when you get out of the train, there was a big poster that the Pew Foundation put up on the wall that had a pig on it, and it said, "This is the biggest consumer of antibiotics in the States." It was basically the pig. And the marketing was very effective, and it wasn't a coincidence. It was at the Capitol. And so I think there's this perception from medical community that we just hand out antibiotics to every animal from birth until it gets slaughtered, and it's a never-ending stream of antibiotics. We're the most irresponsible users of antibiotics on the planet. And yet, when we look at our medical community, there's some challenges there too. And so part of the issue is balancing or framing that conversation and saying not every animal receives an antibiotic every day of its life, that those are very strategically used, and there's some responsible or prudent use antibiotic positions that are out there, especially from the American Veterinary Medical Association that has tried to advance that conversation. But the MDs, that's still even a bigger, we think there's challenges talking to consumers. Talking to MDs is even a more challenging thing because there's a little bit of science in that conversation, and it's a dangerous thing. And a lot of ego. So I think that's part of the discussion, is actually really giving them a realistic view of what actually gets done. When you're in the company of MDs, the first response you get is, "So why didn't you guys vaccinate against disease?" You know, it's like that's the novel concept that they're contributing to the discussion. In the meantime, you know, all of our, you know, vaccination programs have been in place for decades. But the challenge we have is that a lot of our production systems have co-evolved with antibiotics. As antibiotics have been used, our production systems have co-evolved with those antibiotics. And so when folks say, now we need to take the antibiotics out of those systems, it changes the way that those systems operate. And so I think that that's one of the things that we have to face as an industry, is how do we break that codependence? Because there are certain stages of the production cycle where we do use antibiotics for a variety of reasons, and we do raise a healthier product for doing it. But it's being able to overcome the issue of now this is contributing to antibiotic resistance, and that's a link that's still missing. We still need to understand that association. But it's a challenge because we have this codependency with these drugs that we've generated over the last few decades.
That's a really good point. I hadn't really considered it in exactly those terms. So I have a really good story to tell you. So I have a couple of different times spoken to dietetics interns at KU Med and also at K-State, and really had a chance to connect with some of those people that will be on the front lines for dietetics, and had some great responses, just specifically as the producer just saying, here's what I do, here's how I raise cattle, and they've been really good questions and good considerations. But keeping that in mind, when I was at KU Medical Center with my son awaiting a liver transplant, he was very, very sick and not digesting anything, and so he had muscle wasting. So the doctor said, I'm going to send in a dietitian to talk to you because we need to keep him, maintain his weight. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. So she walks in, and, you know, I'm already kind of sitting back with my arms crossed. Here we go. Let's hear what she has to say. And she says, we are focused on a high-protein, high-calorie diet for your young man, and he needs to be eating lots of lean meat first on his plate. And the organic word never came up, natural never came up, any of that kind of consideration. It was all nutritional. It was basically how important it is that he gets lots of protein and, in his situation, lots of calories. As an aside, he's still on that high-calorie, high-protein diet, and unfortunately, I think I've been on it for a while, too. But my 19-year-old boy has gained back a bunch of weight, and he's living on a 3,000 to 4,000-calorie diet right now. Yeah, that's nuts, but he's spectacular. So after the liver transplant, they did have another dietitian come in and talk to him a little bit more about his continued diet. And tell me, for a teenage boy, what's that? Yeah, right. So, and he's going to move into a fraternity, and so I know that's going to get even worse. But I feel really, really good about, and I met with, over the course of 3 weeks, probably three or four different dietitians, and they all had the same message. Nobody came up with one thing is better than another. They were all focused on truly quality calories, and that made me feel really, really good. So, and I never told them that we were cattle ranchers until afterwards. So,
I'm a big believer in high protein, high calorie diets, by the way. So, yes.
Well, we're not going to get into that. The point is I do have a 10-year-old. And so I asked him, after this whole thing, has anybody talked to you at school about animal rights, how you treat animals? And in Edmond, Oklahoma, they don't talk to them. I don't think through the Midwest it's much of a concern. But my concern is where the population is in our country, on the East Coast and West Coast, and higher populated areas, is it something that we as producers need to be looking at the funds that it takes to educate America's youth so that the next generation that's going to be buying our pork chops and our ribeyes are going to be those kids that are going to walk in and buy that meat and not concerned about how we're treating our animals and where that meat comes from? Is that a concern that you feel that we need to be focusing on more? Because I'll tell you, Forrest Lucas is, I mean, he's willing to put millions of dollars into this for that education because these radical organizations are.
I can tell you, too, just had Kevin Murphy on with Food Chain Communications, and he points out, he spends a lot of time on college campuses. He says the land-grant universities are the hotbeds for the anti-animal movement and the Michael Pollans and all these, that it's almost mandatory in some of these classrooms in our land-grant universities where you would think that's the safe haven for production agriculture. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, so from my viewpoint, I think you're exactly right, Kent. And Kelly was up here just about jumping out of her chair because I guess she's probably, her kids have heard some of the anti-movement. And I think we just have to keep in mind that all of those different levels of consumers, those kids are not making the decisions yet, but they do watch commercials. They do listen to some things that come through their school, and they do tell mom and dad that when you're shopping that I want Fruit Loops or I want organic or I want, they know those things. So one of the things that I really encourage people to do when they're wanting to get involved in advocacy, it's free, is take a couple of books to your kindergarten, first and second grade, and offer to those teachers to read them. And they can be farm-based books, they can be specifically about animals or whatever you want it to be. And then that gives that teacher 10 or 15 minutes that they have a few minutes off to take a breather. They love it. And to follow up then, the kids have met a real live rancher or farmer. And you can answer questions and say, yeah, I love cows. And connect with them, and they've met somebody right up front, and that cost us nothing. And I do it a lot.
The commercials that we see on TV are about, you know, like you said, they're all about raising money. And those commercials are very emotional. For young people, they see animals being mistreated on these television commercials, and it affects them. And I wanted to get your feeling on whether we, as leaders in agriculture, animal agriculture, and agriculture in general, do we need to be more focused on education of America's next generation.
I think we do, and I focus on those that generation all the time. But it's got to be a local situation, and we can have specifically producers going and meeting with kids. That's a real plus. And I will tell you too, I speak all the time to groups of people that want to get involved in advocacy, and that is one of the things that they always ask me is, do you have a list of books that we could do that with? That they're fired up about doing that, and a lot of them do end up in classrooms, and they email me back and say that they've been to 20 or 30 classrooms, you know, in a year, and getting to visit with kids and, you know, taking two or three different books. So it's pretty awesome. I think that's really important. Hey, you know, in 4-H, if your son is in 4-H, there was there for a while, what was it? Gosh, I think it was the conference in Chicago. I can't remember exactly, but, you know, you put forth the global conference, I can't remember, but you put forth your topic, what you want to do, and they vote and decide which topics are going to be presented by which groups, and HSUS got a topic in there 1 year. Hey, we can't let that happen. These are our 4-H kids. They're not all farm kids, but that's our roots. We can't let that happen without some sort of response and let those kids know where we're coming from.
I had the talk with my 7-year-old granddaughter, not that talk, a different talk, the talk about, because she loves meat, and I was explaining to her that, you know, cow, hamburger, the relationship, and I was thinking, do I tell her the cow has to die for you to have the hamburger? And we talked about it, and her response was, good, I want the hamburger. So she was fine with it once I explained it to her, the reason we have cows, the purpose of them, and all that. But if they're getting a different message, their reaction is certainly going to be a lot. Because I've noticed with her, she's very passionate at 7 years old about what she's already decided she thinks is important. So if you get to them and with an anti-animal agriculture message, they're going to become, you know, they're going to be out there spreading that message.
Especially as a teenager then, too. You look at that, that's when they're trying to assert their independence, and they've decided they're going to be a vegan at you know, 12 or whatever, 13, and affect everybody around them in their decisions, and they don't even understand what they've done. I wanted to kind of follow up with that, though, too. One of the things that I do as far as those discussions is wherever I go out in public away from ag people, I wear not a flashy pair of cowboy boots, but an attention-getting pair of cowboy boots. And so when people say, hey, I like your boots, I can say, yes, thank you. I'm a cattle rancher in Kansas. And that takes a second or two. And I've had these conversations on a plane, in an airport, on a subway. And after a second or two, they go, you are? Really? How do you do that? It's a perfect opening, a perfect opportunity. And the question that I have gotten frequently is, well, how can you raise those cows and then kill them? And I say it is my responsibility to give that cow or that animal an absolutely awesome life, because that is my responsibility. And in order to do that, they don't know what's coming. I'm not going to tell them what's coming. They're not, you know, you're teaching them, you're treating them the right way. It's productive, but it's also the right thing to do. And so if I can give them the respect and to have, for them to have a good, healthy life, clear up until the end when they're walking up that slaughterhouse deal and they end their life with a knock in the head, it's over. And their food. And that's my purpose, that they have a good life.
That's a good wrap-up, and we need to wrap up. Hans, any final thoughts here?
Just one additional comment to that, and I've been really impressed. The University of Nebraska put together a really nice program for 4-H's on animal welfare. And so it's sort of taking it from the other perspective is that in addition to addressing the youth that are not exposed to agriculture, we also need to take a look at the ones that are and kind of give them some perspective of what the landscape is looking like from an animal welfare perspective and help them or equip them to be able to address these types of questions moving forward, because that's the generation that's going to be within the environment that could potentially be hostile from an animal welfare perspective. And so giving them those tools is really valuable. And they started this program called Welfare Wednesdays, and they got different speakers, and I was fortunate to be involved, and it was just a sit by your computer, speak into a camera type of event. But they video captured it, and so it was available for these kids to look at. And so I think it's a really good opportunity for us to also address that part of the equation, because I think we need to equip the youth that will be engaged in agriculture in the future to be able to address these issues as well.
Steve?
Yeah, I think we have to recognize the potential damage that these situations can do. There's no question about that. I think one of the big answers to this is, as I pointed out earlier, is transparency. I don't know how many of you have viewed the videos of the Glass Walls Project that AMI put out with Temple Grandin that follows a pig from the farm through the slaughterhouse. It follows a calf from the feedlot through the slaughterhouse. I mean, you know... The answer to, you know, how can you eat those animals is because the purpose of those animals being on this earth is to feed people, and people's welfare is what we're really interested in. I think when we look at it from that standpoint, again, using the data available, so far I can't see where there's been a lot of damage done on the consumer side at this point. Now, you know, why are all these companies making decisions that are saying, well, their consumers want this? Because they don't want somebody protesting in front of their stores, okay? In most cases, it's not their customers that have made this decision. It's some pressure group on them. And I again would offer the data that says the consumer demand is still strong as evidence that it's probably not the consumers that necessarily are doing it. Yes, some people want different product. There's no question about that. They want it this way, or they want free-range eggs or whatever. And if they want to, we ought to offer them those choices. The, you know, economics and to some degree animal well-being is all a matter of trade-offs. I mean, the trade-off for a sow in a stall is a sow in a pen with 5 other or 10 other or 100 other sows. And I've been there. That can be pretty ugly sometimes, okay? And so it's an issue of trade-offs. And people are going to vote with their dollars on what trade-off to be made. The issue, to my mind, is let's make sure it's people voting with their dollars and not somebody between us and them that's causing that to happen.
All right. Let's give our panel a big round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, panel. Thank you all for coming. We have, Lifestyle Publications has our ticketed event next door, and most of you, I think, are already, have made reservations to attend. But if any of you would like to join us, there are ladies out there by the door that would be glad to get you signed up. It starts with a social hour, and then there will be a dinner and some recognitions of awards that Livestock Publications Council makes each year. Our sponsors for that event, our gold sponsor is John Deere, and the silver sponsor is Pork Checkoff. And so you'll enjoy hearing a little bit about them, too. So thank you again for coming. Thank you again for speaking with us. And we hope to see you next year at the second Vision event.